shared themselves with us this weekend. It was wonderful for me to hear you and share that, spend time with you, and it convinces me once again that we're all one big family, and I hope that we keep sharing our Dharma with each other. As has been mentioned already this weekend, it's a tendency for human beings to separate, and in my practice is the best, or, you know, we build walls and fences and names and ideas. And it's a human condition, and it's really very destructive. And we are very lucky in this country because we have this melting pot and this opportunity to share ideas. And, but it has to be a real active effort, or it's not going to happen. There's this inertia and this pull towards separation all the time. I'd especially like to thank Susie for conceiving and planning this wonderful thing, and she really worked very hard, and she's doing a lot of other things right now. She's just made a huge upheaval in her life this year, and she still had a lot of energy for this, and I'm really, really grateful. So the title of my talk is Believing in Yourself, and I thought of that. I was sitting in a session with Suzuki Roshi in last April, and I was about the fourth day of the retreat, and as some of you might know, there's four interviews a day, and I was on about to have my 16th interview or something. Ellen was there with me, and he's just so different than what I'm used to with Sansanim. And I'd answered a couple of questions okay with him, and then there's this one that I'd been on for a day and a half or for a while, and just kept thinking, you know, where's my mistake? And this wonderful sitting was so strict and strong, and all of a sudden this wave went through me. It was this wonderful feeling of just that I'd had before many times. It just all of a sudden, I got it, you know, you just have to believe in yourself. It's not the word. He's not so much looking for the word. He's looking for the belief, the confidence, and just to have it come out. And really, it's very strong. And then I thought of this conference. So that it was already in the making. And I went, Susie had already mentioned that she'd like a title for my talk. And I went, believing in yourself, that's what we need, you know. And I went up and I answered a call, and it was great. It was the same answer I'd given him the 2 hours earlier, you know. I just had that, you know. I didn't care what he said back. It was wonderful. So that's how I thought of the title. I have no context to it, really, but it's a nice title. I also brought a book list with me. It's just one book on it, though. It's called The Ant and the Elephant. By Bill Peet. And I think I did this one time before. I brought one of Annie's books with me. I just been reading this to her this afternoon after lunch. And oh, what a talk. It's really a nice book. But it has great illustrations, too. Here we are. Tumbling into a ravine. That's the elephant. And this story is about an elephant that, well, first it begins with an ant that's gotten swept down a river and just about is drowned, and it snags onto a twig and crawls up onto safety out of the water. And it goes on that turtle is right near him, so he calls out to the riverbank, you know, please help me, in his wee little voice. And the turtle's just come out of the water and doesn't need to swim anymore, and is ready to sun himself, so he says, no, you know, I just had my swim, I'm sorry. And leaves the ant stranded, tries to crawl up on a rock to sun himself, and he falls backwards on his back and can't get back, so he's in this helpless situation, just like the ant. So he calls out to this bird and says, please help me, and the bird says, laughing at his predicament, says, you old codger, you old fool, how did you get yourself into such a situation? I can't help you. And she started to debate him more with bad speech, and she, as she leaned over her nest, she knocked her egg off out of the tree, and thank God it wasn't cracked or anything. She flew down to pick it up, and she tried to get it in her big mouth, you know, her big beak, and but she couldn't. She couldn't flap her wings hard enough to get her big, heavy beak, her big mouth, and her big baby off the ground. There's all the symbolism, you know. Really, these books are amazing. And so a giraffe is walking by and says, please, please help me. I can't get my egg off the ground. And surely with your flat, high head, you could balance us both on top of your head and put us back up in the nest. And the giraffe says, he's very arrogant, you know, has arrogant karma. He says, oh, I can't stoop so low to help someone like you. And so goes walking off with his nose in the air. And since he's not looking down, he gets entangled in a tangle vine. And he's very annoyed at this hindrance and pushing. And the harder he pushes, the more legs he gets. And freezing all four of his legs are all bunched together in his spine. And I should probably show you the pictures. And so he's helpless, and he sees this lion walking by, and he says, please, please help me, I'm tangled in this vine. And the lion, of course, thinks it's his pride. So great big, he says, you know, with your big paws, you can swipe these vines away from my legs. And he has all this pride, and he goes, oh no, and he starts laughing at the elephant. And he's laughing so hard, he just thumps down on the ground, and this big rock boulder falls over and lands on his tail, so he can't get away from the rock. And this rhino goes by with this big, strong, snooty nose, and says, you know, so the lion says, come on, you know, push this rock off. And the rhino says, no, you know, I've got better things to do. And so he has this karma of just going straight ahead, stubborn, and not looking ahead, you know. And so he just lands into a stump. His horn goes into a stump. And so he's mad at the stump, you know, at this hindrance, and so he pushes really hard to push it away, you know, and get away from me, you know. And so he just runs its horn even deeper into the stump, and then he decides to try to pull away, and it's too late, he's too deeply embedded. Then the elephant appears, you know. Finally the elephant comes, and this elephant has these huge ears and can hear any sound in the forest, and so he hears the ants plead to please help me. So he puts his trunk out and saves the ant. And the ant is so grateful and really, really grateful. And says, I wish I could thank you. I'm so teeny, I can't thank you, but just thank you, thank you, thank you. He runs off into the grass. And then the elephant's walking by and sees the turtle, and the turtle says, come on, you oaf, flip me over. You haven't got anything better to do. And so he flips the turtle over. And the turtle doesn't even say thanks, you know. And he sees the bird and helps with the egg, and they're all ungrateful for his, you know, he helps them with no obligation, you know, no condition, and just, he helps the bird, and he helps the lion, and he helps the giraffe, and he helps the rhino. None of them thanked him. And then the elephant, who is this strong, you know, wonderful person that always helps and never expects any thanks, but there's still something there, you know, he's walking along. First you think it's just going to be the perfect image of goodness, but it had this idea of, wow, at least I'm strong enough that I can never get into any trouble. I've got it together. So my body's so big, and there's nothing that can trap me. And then the ravine appears, and the elephant tumbles in such a way it lands right on its back, and it's wedged, it's 4 tons wedged into this, and it can't reach with its tusks or with its legs to get out. It screams, you know, help, 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 really loudly, and soon night settles in, and nobody heard his plea, except all of a sudden he has big ears, and he picks up this little and what is it? It's the ant and its 95,000 friends. So like the 10,000 hands, 10,000 eyes appear. And the elephant says, oh, you know, my friend, I remember you from this morning, but how could you possibly help me? You're so teeny. He says, well, I have my 95,000 friends with me. And so they crawl down, and the ants are so strong, and so, you know, how they are. So And the 95,000 pull, you know, inch by inch by inch, get the elephant up over the ravine, and he's saved. And he says, oh, how can, you know, it's, thank you so much, and let me give you a ride back to your ant hole. And they say, well, we don't really need a ride. We're not tired right now. We feel wonderful, you know, because we helped you. And he says, well, come with us. Let's go for a ride together anyway. So they all crawl up his legs, and they ride off, and there's all the little ants ride off together. No, neither one depended on the other one anymore. So maybe you get the symbolism. I think this year, you know, a lot of the Zen centers have been having trouble, and all of past couple of years, I think all of us have had a lot of hard times. Most people I know, anyway. All those things that we think of as hard times don't really have to be a hard time at all. I mean, they can be Chosen was saying, that's your teacher. You know, all those things are your teacher. And you know, the different traps, you know, the arrogance or laughing at someone, or you know, laziness. The turtle was just lazy and didn't care. And all those things, you know, it's kind of funny because before Chosen talked, I still had some material for my talk, but after she talked, it was all gone. You know? The same idea, you know, of it's just how everything is your teacher, and it's you say thank you when something like that, anything, when 1983 appeared, 1984 appeared, you know, thank you. And once you've really attained that mind, really have completely digested it and experienced it, and it's yours, it's not just some idea you heard from someone, but you really start to see that it's for you. You know, all the things that appear in this universe is for each one of us. And there's no winning and no losing anymore. And that's freedom, that's real freedom. Freedom from life and death, freedom from winning and losing, freedom from pride and arrogance and everything. I just led a retreat up in Toronto last weekend, and it's a small center that we've had for several years now, and it was a really wonderful retreat. It was nice kind of weather like this, more people at the retreat than usual, and everybody felt really good, and it was just a really wonderful retreat. And at the end, you know, we always have a circle talk at the end of our retreats, and we all shared something about the retreat, and several people told me, you know, they only see a teacher about every 3 or 4 months, so they're just hungry and grateful. You could say anything, and they, oh, thank you for, you know, just like they just want to hear it. And it's really easy because that feeds your dharma when someone just expects you to say something nice, you know, it's like, it comes out, and they almost draw it out of you, I find. So three of them took me to the airport the next morning when I had to leave, and they were just like, oh, Bobby, you know, I can't wait till you come back, and it was such a great retreat, and I was just kind of gawky-eyed, you know, they really were impressed with my teaching or something, and I was like, I just saw the orange light, you know, the caution light of, well, look at this one, you know. That's dangerous, you know, that idea of people liking your teaching or, you know, wanting you. It's not any different. It weighs exactly the same as someone saying, oh, well, thanks a lot, but I'd rather have so-and-so come up and teach. You weren't so great, you know. It's the same thing, you know. If one of those touches you more than the others, you've got a problem. You're clinging, you're grabbing, you don't believe in yourself, you know. You need good speech to feel good about yourself, or if someone gives you bad speech, it's like devastating. And it's, you know, either one is doesn't need to touch you, and it's wonderful at the time. If someone tells you, you know, your teaching is really inadequate and shallow, and you really need to do some more sitting, you know, that's okay. You know, it's possible to receive that with your mind not moving that much. I think, you know what I mean? The same thing is, oh, wow, you're great, I can't wait till you come back. And same thing, your mind doesn't need to move. It's just, either one, you can feel a little sad about one and really a little proud about the other one, or happy. Just happy that you made people happy. But then it's gone. Then you're getting on the airplane, you know, and you're watching the old lady trying to pick up her heavy bag, you notice, and you help her carry it or something. It's just, then you're right there the next moment. And I think that's a very That's what you, that's the goods you get from sitting and practicing and letting go of yourself. That's the real prize in Zen, is that being able to enter the next moment with no trace of the last one. I want to share one woman's story that I told the same story last year, but I don't think anybody, some people understood it, but I don't think I can tell it any better this year, but it's it's real helpful. It was real helpful to me, so I want to share it. At one point, after Sansini had been around, my teacher had been around for about 6 or 8 months in this country, everybody was always asking him questions about Korea and Buddhism and enlightenment and all those things. And somebody asked him whether there were any women Zen masters in Korea, and he goes, I think there might be. Are there? I don't even remember.
Yes.
There's a couple, but at the time, I think he said no. He goes, women can't get enlightenment. And he kind of, he was, well, anyway, you'll see when I finish, but he goes, oh, women can't get enlightenment. And I looked at him, and I think I was the only woman in the room. And he'd been giving these wonderful Dharma talks, and I loved him. He's this great talks about, don't make man, don't make woman, don't make anything. And, it's the way the lines he always gives, it's really good teaching. And I was going, Sansanim, you always say that, originally there's nothing, and there's, don't make distinctions, and don't make good and bad, and want man and woman. And what do you mean women can't get enlightenment? Now, he was kind of walking into the kitchen. He kind of was walking away from me when I was starting to, run up behind him, strangle him. I wasn't angry. I was shocked that he was saying that. I was going, what are you talking about? And he looked at me with his twinkle, with his twinkle in his eye. He goes, just when I said, what do you mean women can't get enlightenment? He goes, so you're a woman. Just boom. It just made woman, so you're a woman. And, Chosen said that, yes, women cannot get enlightenment. If you can't get enlightenment if you're a woman, and you can't get it if you're a man, you can't get it if you're a tree or a rock or a stone or you're a transvestite, you can't get it if you're anything, if you're clinging to that thing, I am a woman or I am a man, it's gone already. Enlightenment has passed through your fingers. It's not a thing. You can't get it. Nobody can get it. Buddha didn't get it either, And that's a hard one to get, but it's true. Buddha didn't get it, so we don't have to worry. We're all in the same family. That's what, it's wonderful. I can't remember whether it was Zen Master Wangpo. We could say some of us in Korea, the way Sansini teaches us the Zen Master's name might be a little bit different, but we call him Wangpo or Unmun. I think it was one of them that that said that you have to become as if you say, just picture yourself as this ant with little, real sensitive little feelers. Just really sensitive. That's how they stay alive and find their food, and everything depends on those feelers. Very, very sensitive. And the metaphor was that to really attain, to really understand yourself, you can't let those feelers move at all, not one teeny vibration from either one of them. It has to be complete, not moving. And in a sense of that, if anything, any phenomena that appears in our life makes us, we use the word check ourselves, or doubt ourselves, or doubt someone else, thinking, dividing, separating. If it just moves just a fraction, that you're already lost, you're already gone straight to hell. So that's how, and that's how, sometimes that sounds so difficult. Well, how could I ever be so clear that my mind doesn't move it, at all, that I can always just, be there? Well, then you're gone. That's checking, that's thinking. And the only time that the feeler is not moving at all is when you're just doing something, And as we've heard this teaching by all these wonderful women, just whatever it is, it's not the dishwater or the 90-day retreat. Either one is food for our practice, and one's not better than the other. you know, sometimes one's more supportive than the other, and we have to get sensitive and balanced about those things, and it's not easy. But even that line, you know, just, oh, it's not easy. What's best? Just then, that's enlightenment. And, at the end of our summer, our winter kyalchi, I think it was, Sansanin was giving a talk, and he was just saying that to everybody, you know, 90 days of sitting, and it was the last day, and I was up there to hear the talk, and he said to everybody, he said, you know, there's this saying that the high-class Zen student, you know, very high-class, all they need to do is hear one word, and they get it, you know, and he said, second class, middle class Zen student, they need to sit a 7-day retreat and then they get it. And he said, it's a low class Zen student, very low class, all they can do is sit 90 days and then they get it. You know? And he said, so did you get it? And he looks at everybody, did you get it? But then everybody's in a puddle, you know, feeling lousy about themselves and oh, I didn't get it. And, it's very, you know, it's like so compassionately and so beautifully. It's just like, to me, sometimes it feels like he's taken out a silver tray and there's maybe, you know, 25 people in the room. He has 25 beautiful little cakes, one just the kind that each person likes to eat, you know, their favorite flavor and taste and color. And so he has one for each person. He's just like going, handing, you know, enlightenment to them, handing that insight of there's nothing to get. You know, he said, so he goes, even right now, you're saying, I didn't get it. He goes, that's I didn't get it enlightenment. That's it, you know. just believe in yourself. Just this mind, this moment. Like, that's the pitch. So I didn't get it. You know, you think that's when I'm at my worst, my unclear state, you know, feeling down about my practice. And he said, that's it. That's your I didn't get it enlightenment. Can't you see that? It's like that to me. That's like the cake or the cookie that he's giving you it. And it, sometimes it's not enough, so another retreat's necessary. or more dishwater, whatever, you know. Then I really only have one more thing that I really wanted to say, and I think it's really important, so I need to say it. And sometimes it feels like it's my trip or my dogmatic part of me or my whatever, my German blood, but it's like there's something that I just think it's so important, and I just want to share it. It's practicing, consistent practicing and perseverance. I just really want to encourage people to find a medium. Tony's not here, so she probably wouldn't appreciate this, and yet it's the same teaching exactly, but in a different, again, working with a different medium. For me, what's been really supportive is finding a teacher and a practice and some medium. It can be anything that helps you practice consistently and to your fullest. And again, it doesn't matter who the teacher is or what the form is, but I really encourage people to you know, if you decide to get up in the morning and do 108 bows or to sit 20 minutes twice a day or do a retreat twice a year or whatever it is, you know, to get yourself to do that. And even if it takes setting a timer on a catapult machine to get you out the door at 7 o'clock that morning when you decide to drive to the retreat, I mean, you really have all this resistance lots of times to that practice. And it's just a real dangerous thing. You know, that resistance is what kills us. And it doesn't come easy. It's not an easy thing to practice hard. And hard, I mean hard. I'm not going to make it sound. Sometimes it's just like we have to force ourselves to pay attention. And again, it can be doing any kind of practice, but it means mindfulness and consistency and accountability to someone. I think it's important. Go and get checked out once in a while and get some feedback about your practice. I think that's real helpful. And this story goes along with that. If anybody's read, I can't remember what book I read the story in, but I haven't read it for about 5 years, so it's totally my version of it. But there was this, up in the seventh heaven or something, there was this, the emperor, the king of kings of all the heavens and all the universes was sitting up on his throne and feeling a bit tired and old and thinking it's time to pass on my responsibilities. And he had an attendant, and he looked at his attendant and said, you know, I think I want to find the person to replace me, the perfect being, the perfect compassionate, all-knowing person to take my place. I'm ready to retire. And so his attendant said, well, how can we find this being? He says, I know. He says, don't worry, we'll find him. He says, there's a certain fellow that I've had my eye on. And it was Shakyamuni Buddha, but I think it was in one of his other incarnations. But anyway, must have been just the way the story ends. It was a different incarnation. So anyway, the King of Kings went flying down over this different realms, and he finally found, you know, the Buddha. And he was, at this time, I think he was like the Buddha was a king or something. He manifested himself as a dove, or as a hawk, and he has a tendon that manifests himself as a dove. And in this book it said that this is a didactic hyperbole, you know, an exaggerated teaching. It's only for, you know, its symbolic meanings. But so he's a hawk, and he's soaring around and making these threatening moves towards the dove. And this is right over the Buddha's head. So the Buddha looks up and very, very compassionate and loving, and he saw the dove's predicament and yelled up to the hawk. He said, please, please don't attack that dove. Don't eat it. And the hawk said, why not? I'm hungry. And he said, oh, the dove will suffer so much. You'll take his life and he'll never, you know, exist again. And he said, please don't kill him. And he said, I'm hungry. And the Buddha said, oh, you can have one of my fingers. You know, I'll give you my finger to eat. It'll certainly fill you. And the hawk said, I'll tell you what, he said, and he produced a scale and said, he put the dove on one side of the scale and it dipped way down. He said, you give me an equal amount of meat and I won't eat the dove. And so the Buddha, you know, chopped off his, this is gross, but again, it's just a didactic hyperbole. But he chopped off his hand and put it on the scale and hardly budged the scale. The dove was still much heavier and the Buddha's like, oh, so he lops off the other hand and puts it on the scale. Still, that is much heavier. And so he continues to dismember himself and try to equal the weight of the dove. And everything he does, I won't go into details, but it just doesn't weigh enough. And he says, well, it's a great question, you know, it's a great question of what can I do? You know, how much can I give? How hard should I practice? You know, what commitment? How much should I persevere? All those things that appear when our practice is genuine, you know, we're just racing through the Buddha's mind, you know, and a great caring mind, you know, what can I do? What can I do? And finally, you know, again, he got it, you know, because he had a strong question and a strong direction, he got it. And he what did he do? He put his whole self on the scale, everything, his whole self, and then much, much heavier. And then, of course, the hawk manifested himself as the King of Kings, and the Buddha became whole again. So, you know, it's you know, you hear these stories about that. This is a real fancy one, you know. Sometimes they're just in China 500 years ago, and then this one's even, you know, older and more lofty. And you know, we tend to think, wouldn't that be great, or isn't that something? But that's us, you know. At this moment, that's our situation, and that dove is always in distress, fluttering over our head in one form or another. And how much, so half the time, most of the time we don't even see it. Most of the time we don't even feel it or sense the sadness that's going on around us because we're not sensitive enough. And then, you know, the more we practice, you begin to, you know, to me it comes in all forms. In one way you begin to see the suffering around you, and you also begin to see your own much more and your own faults and drawbacks. And that's, I think, where a lot of people just draw away from practice. I feel like I've seen that a lot, you know. It's like, God, I'm worse than I was 5 years ago, you know, so. But, you know, maybe not worse, maybe just more aware and more sensitive, beginning to really see that incredible amount of consciousness that we contain, all of us share. I was just at work the other night, and I was really tired. You know, it was 5:30 in the morning. I'd been up since 4:45 the morning before. I was just exhausted and I was pissy. You know, I was just in a bad. I was on this floor I had never worked on before, And I didn't realize how much there was to do between 4 in the morning and 6 in the morning. I thought I could get it, I didn't even start till 4:30. I thought I could get it all done in an hour and a half. And all of a sudden I was just doing these things. It took a long time and there was many more medications than I thought. And I'm a nurse, so I was doing my nursing thing. And so by the time I got to this one lady, I was just I was just sick. I just had to write all these nurses' notes and I wanted to go home. You know, I really wanted to go home. And that mind of just, I want to finish this so I can go home. And I knew, like, in the back of my mind, I went, oh boy, you not clear. But I was just so tired. So I got to this, the last person that needed to take a pill. And people, I didn't know these people. That was the most frustrating part. And I said, you know, can she swallow a pill? Some of them can, some of them can't. So if they can't swallow them, you grind them up and put them in applesauce. And, oh yeah, she can swallow. So I got down there and she's like this. And I went, you know, Mrs. So-and-so, wake up! And she's, I went, wake up! With all the compassion in the world, you know. And she wouldn't wake up. And this was like the day after my Toronto retreat where I'd been so wonderful, you know. They loved me in Toronto. It's like, where was she? I was like, oh, and I saw that too. I went, oh, they loved you in Toronto. Well, look at you now, you know. And so then I was, so like, she's real heavy. And poor lady, I didn't even, you know, she's got a brain tumor. And she just was, she wasn't, you know, she's getting, she had really dropped, really gotten much worse the couple, you know, for the past couple of days. So I'm trying to get her swallowed pill. I gave her like 3 glasses of water. And she goes, I was getting madder and madder at her. And she couldn't swallow. It's fun. I screamed down one of the aides, you know, you get it down her throat. I can't get it down. So she came and did it. But it's like I'd lost it completely, you know, just frustration and impatience and irritation, all the, you know, list of them. And I'm walking down the hall, and it's like that's my frustration, irritation, impatience, lazy karma, you know, and that's my frustration, irritation, impatience, laziness, enlightenment. Just then, if I could just like see it, okay, that's where, look at you, you know. And not like, then you can go on this whole scenario of, oh God, you're not clear, look at 12 years of practicing and look where it got you. Or else just, then just see that as you know, Chosen was saying, it's like, you know, if you can't see that in yourself, then you can't teach anybody else, you can't share that or be anybody else's friend. That's doing that with you, or you've seen that in someone else's. And if you can really, really see that in yourself and just see it, you don't have to feel good about it, you don't have to feel bad about it, just like, well, there you are, you know, take a really good look, and that's wonderful, you know. The next time you see someone else acting that way, there's no separation, it's just complete understanding, and maybe you can give them some support. So that's our job. So easy in a way, and yet. It's hard too. So, so that's why when I did a solo retreat about 6 years ago, a 100-day retreat by myself, and I asked Santanim for a calligraphy to put on my wall for inspiration, and he gave me one that said, 10,000 years, try, try, try. Non-stop. And so, you know, 50 days into the retreat, 63 days into the retreat, I'd look at that and go, 100 days. It's not, you know, there was less self, you know, oh, I'm doing 100-day retreat. It's like 10,000 years, you know, try, try, try. It's really helpful to put that into your head once in a while. And he gave me another clue. I only asked for one, but then he handed me this other one I really didn't want. It. Especially when I saw it, it said the bone of space. Yeah. The bone of space, what is that? What is the bone of space? Couldn't get it. I took it on my retreat. I was, come on, you know, the bone of space. 90 days, 95 days, 96 days. What is the bone of space? Don't know. You know? And the end of my 100-day retreat, my last sitting period, no, still, what is the bonus space? And I was thinking, oh, this is my last 10 minutes of my 100-day retreat. The Buddha, the altar looked just like it did the first day. I thought maybe I'd see some flashing lights or something. Or somebody would come in and give me good words or something, you know, some special bean. And same room, same temperature, same everything. It was warmer, actually. It turned May, so it was warmer, but like nothing special. Nothing special. It's like, not special. And I still didn't even answer this con. And then it was over, and same, you know. Didn't know that, and the room looked the same, and it was wonderful. I'm like, that's okay. So it's nothing special is important too. Try, and nothing special, and you can't lose. So with that, again, I'm just really grateful for everybody that came also. And I guess we'll give a word for the kitchen and all that stuff later. It's been nice. I hope we can do it again next year in some form. And I'd like to also say that Geshen mentioned this, that if we could somehow, I don't know of the logistics, but somehow, you mentioned having the monk's vows or the nun's vows be the same, and you know, some way to have teachers that are coming into the country have that agreement, and have this country have that agreement, and other agreements. So I'd love to have like the same English Heart Sutra version for all the Zen centers, mm-hmm. and little things like that would be really nice, and maybe I just hope somehow we can just do more networking and keep getting together like this. Thank you.